Shalom Aleichem, sweetest friends. We are continuing our series of Shi'ulim in the topic of Bnei Noach, Chiyuv Misa for Bnei Noach. And we're going to be basing this shiur on the Torah of the great Gaon Leich Shlita. The question is, what's the legitimacy of capital punishment in our general society? Even the staunchest advocates of capital punishment freely conclude that present Batei Din, or even the Sanhedrin, were possible to reestablish that institution, aren't obligated to impose capital punishment, nor do they have discretionary power to do so. As a matter of law, it is quite evident that even during the period of the Second Commonwealth, instances of execution were few and far between. Mishnah Makkos in the Zion of Aleph says that a court which imposes the death penalty once in 7 years is chablonis, is destructive, is unduly punitive in nature. Husband Isaiah applies this epithet to a court that imposes the death penalty once in 70 years. The laws of evidence and the mode of examination to which witnesses were subjected made it difficult to secure a conviction in the vast majority of cases. The court was given discretion to subject witnesses to particularly rigorous examination with regard to the most trivial details of matters irrelevant to the substance of their testimony. The witnesses were separated from one another, and each was questioned in detail. Given the faulty nature of human memory, it is not at all difficult to evoke inconsistencies and discrepancies in the testimony of various witnesses. Contradictory statements by witnesses, even with regard to such ancillary matters as the color of the garment worn by the accused or number of buttons on a cloak, constituted sufficient reason for exclusion of their testimony. Retired from Rabbi Akiva said that if they had been members of the Sanhedrin, no man would ever have been put to death. Giving examples, they indicated that they would have demanded testimony so specific as to be unobtainable. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, in stating his opposition to such a policy, predicates his view upon the fear that were capital punishment to be abolished, bloodshed might become rampant. Moreover, the Gemara in Sanhedrin Mem Aleph from the Aleph reports that for some 40 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the concomitant loss of judicial autonomy, members of the Great Sanhedrin declined to convene within the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash because they no longer wished lower courts to sit in capital cases. Halacha stipulates that capital punishment may be imposed by local Sanhedrin Ketana composed of 23 judges only when the 71 members Great Sanhedrin San Beis Din HaGadol meets within the confines of the Harabais. Taking notice of the increasing incidence of homicide, the Sanhedrin recognized that capital punishment imposed by the courts had lost its deterrent force, and under such circumstances the Sanhedrin was unwilling to continue to impose this harsh penalty. It's clear that among Jews, capital punishment was imposed only rarely and with the greatest of reluctance. With the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the statutory death penalty lapsed entirely. In establishing this rule, the Gemara in Sanhedrin quotes the pasuk, "The kamta v'alisa l'makon asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha, you shall arise and go to the place which Hashem chooses, and you should come to the Kohanim, Levim, v'ashefet asher yeh b'yamim ahem." The Kohanim, Levim, and judges who will be in those days, judicial authority was vested in the courts, not in the Kohanim and Levim. Reference to Kohanim and Levim in this context is therefore incongruous. The Gemara declares that the juxtaposition of the terms Kohanim and Levim with Shoftim serves to teach that judges may impose the death penalty only during such periods as the Kohen performs his priestly functions in conjunction with the Dinei HaKarbanos. The concluding phrase, "and go up to the place which the Lord your God shall choose," serves to establish a second condition, that such penalty may be imposed by the courts only when the Sanhedrin HaGadol sits in the place which the Lord your God shall choose, i.e. within the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash. Citing these considerations of Yitzchak Isaac Alevi Herzog in Yavnen, the third volume, put out in Nisan in the year Tovshin Tes, on page 10, expressed opposition to the introduction of capital punishment in the state of Israel. We don't have the Kohanim and Levim doing their avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, and we don't have the Sanhedrin Agadol in the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash. The Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin 14:11 codifies both requirements in ruling that the death sentence may not be imposed in the absence of either of these two conditions. Another impediment to imposition of capital punishment is a lack of qualified judges. In order to sit in judgment in capital cases, as well as in some areas of jurisprudence involving imposition of fines, the judges must be recipients of smicha conferred upon them for this purpose. Smicha was transmitted by the ordainer to the ordainee in an unbroken line of succession, having its origin in the appointment of Moshe by Moshe of the 70s Canaan, as we see in Devarim 11:16, 17, 24, 25, and the Rambam Sanhedrin Daled Aleph. The chain of transmission was interrupted in the middle of the 4th century as a result of persecution. See the Ramban in his Hasaga to the Sefer HaMitzvos in Essay 153. We had a long shiur already, two shiurim, about the attempt to restore the institution of smicha made in Tzfas in 1538 by Rav Yaakov Beirav, based on Rambam, Sanhedrin 4:11, the effect that all the Chachomim residing in Eretz Yisrael, even though they themselves lack smicha, may nevertheless collectively confer smicha, and any person so ordained is thereby privileged to ordain others. This action was bitterly opposed by Rav Yaakov, Rav Levi ben Yaakov ibn Chabib, who at the time was the foremost Talmud Chacham in Yerushalayim. The latter Talmud Chacham composed a treatise entitled Kuntres HaSmicha in Venice, 1565, detailing, I don't know why it was published in Venice, detailing the reasons for his opposition. As a result, no further candidates were ordained, and the institution of Smicha was allowed to lapse. Besides the discussion we had, it's discussed by the famous professor Jacob Katz in the Tzion History Journal, put out in 1951, pages 28 to 45, a comprehensive list of articles written in recent years dealing with the question of smicha in conjunction with the issue of reinstitution of Sanhedrin appears in Professor Nachum Rakover Shlita's Otzar Mishpat, which is published in Yerushalayim in 1975, on pages 161 to 163. The obligations and powers of non-Jewish courts are markedly different. Gentiles are not bound by the Tayag mitzvahs revealed to Jews at Sinai, but are obligated by the Sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach. The Noachide code is primarily restrictive rather than prescriptive in nature, and bans reprehensible activities such as murder, theft, sexual immorality, etc. The last in the series of commandments is known as dinim. The specific nature of this precept is the subject of disagreement among early rabbinic authorities. The Ramban, in his Parish to the Chumash, in Bereshis 34:13, understands this command as a general obligation with regard to the establishment of laws and regulations essential to the maintenance of a social order. For example, laws governing commerce and interpersonal behavior, laws banning theft and fraud, laws regulating payment of wages, bailment, etc. The Ramban understands the substance of this commandment to be significantly different. The Ramban in Melachim 9:14 formulates this obligation as follows, translating into English. In what way are they commanded with regard to dinim? They are obligated to seat judges in every single district to render judgment with regard to these six commandments and to admonish the populace. A Noachide who transgresses one of these seven commandments is to be put to death by the sword. For this reason, all the inhabitants of Shechem became liable to be put to death, for Shechem committed an act of robbery, and they saw and knew, and did not impose judgment upon him. The reason he said before these six, because the seventh is dinim, to make the courts. Thus, according to Rambam, not only are non-Jews obliged to impose capital punishment for violation of the Noahide code, but failure to do so is itself a capital infraction of that code, since the Talmudic texts and discussions which speak of the lapse of capital punishment subsequent to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash refer only to the obligations of a Jewish Beis Din governed by the Sinaitic code, there is no immediate reason to assume that the obligations of Noahites with regard to the imposition of capital punishment are in any way diminished in our day. Tshuvas HaBach, Simon Kuf Yud Aleph, explicitly affirms that capital punishment may be imposed in our day for non-Jews for violation of the Noahide code. Also in the Tshuvas Chacham Tzvi, Simon Pei Dalet, certainly no statement to that effect appears in any of the codes or in the writings of any early authority. Such a suggestion does, however, appear in an early 20th century commentary of the Mishneh Torah, the Tzofnas Paneach, authored by the great Goin, we've had many, many shiurim in the Torah, of Rav Yosef Rosen of Dvinsk. Jewish law requires that Canaanite slaves, Avadim Kenanim, be converted to Judaism, and prohibits Jews from owning slaves who decline to do so. The Rambam in Milo 1:6 codifies the ruling which prohibits the retention for longer than a period of 12 months of a Canaanite slave who refuses to undergo conversion through circumcision. However, Rambam further rules that prior to his sale to a Jewish master, the slave may stipulate that he will accept only a Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, and under such circumstances the slave may be retained by his Jewish master. The Rambam concludes, however, if the slave does not accept the Sheva Mitzvahs which the sons of Noach were commanded, he is put to death immediately. In a gloss appended to this ruling, the Ravid tersely comments, he is to be sold immediately. It is not for us now to kill any person. The Kesef Mishnah explains the Ravid's position by stating that the ruling here codified by Rambam is identical with that included by him in Hilchos Malachim 8:10, to the effect that all Gentile inhabitants of Eretz Yisrael must accept the commandments of the Noahide code or face death. The Kesef Mishnah further notes, states that Rambam's ruling pertaining to the execution of Noahites who fail to accept the obligations imposed upon them by the Noahide code is enforceable only when Gentiles are subject to Jewish jurisdiction. Hence, even for Rambam, this provision is essentially theoretical and cannot be implemented in practice. It is precisely the latter point which Ravid underscores in his gloss. Understood in this manner, there exists no disagreement between the Rambam and the Ravid with regard to this salient point. The Rambam, according to Kesef Mishnah, would agree that in practice, the Eved Kenani, the Canaanite slave, who refuses to accept the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, cannot be executed. The Tzafnas Paneach does, however, posit a dispute between Rambam and Ravid, and he says they disagree with regard to whether now, in our day, when we have no Sanhedrin and cannot execute capital punishment, the law is also the same with regard to Noahides, i.e. they disagree with regard to whether Noahides may be executed subsequent to the abolition of the Sanhedrin. According to the Tzofnas Paneach's understanding of the Ravid, it is due to statutory restriction rather than to lack of judicial jurisdiction that the death penalty cannot be imposed. Even according to this analysis, which is hardly indisputable, there is some ambiguity with regard to whether Tzofnas Paneach means to say that it is only Jewish courts which, according to Ravid, cannot impose the death penalty upon Gentiles, or whether Gentiles themselves are also precluded from imposing capital punishment. Granting the Tzofnas Paneach's basic interpretation of the Ravid's position, the former would appear to be the more logical of the two possibilities, since the Talmudic exegesis, which serves to debar capital punishment in the absence of ongoing performance of the sacrificial rituals, is presented in the context of delineation of regulations governing penalties imposed by Jewish courts. Any ambiguity which exists is, however, limited to Tzofnas Penech's understanding of Ravid. According to either interpretation of Tzofnas Penech's comments, Rambam's position is that capital punishment is mandated and must be imposed for transgression of the Noahide code, even in our day. Of even more significance, insofar as actual execution of capital punishment is concerned, are the rules of evidence governing criminal proceedings under Noahide law. Jewish courts require testimony of at least two credible eyewitnesses. For imposition of either corporal or capital punishment, the Torah explicitly says, at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he who is worthy of death be put to death. The testimony of a single witness and a fortiori kal vachomer, circumstantial evidence, is not admissible. The testimony of witnesses who have actually seen the act may be dispensed with only if culpability can be inferred with absolute certainty from the facts to which the eyewitness testimony is presented. For example, Shavuos 46b states that liability for battery may be established even if witnesses have not observed the act itself, provided that the evidence incontrovertibly established A, that the wound could not possibly be accidental or self-inflicted, i.e. a bite at the back, on the back, or on the elbow joint, and B, that no other person was present, and hence the defendant must have committed the act. Tosis in Shavuos 34a asserts that such evidence may be admitted in capital cases. As well, the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos Leisasei 290, basing himself upon the Mechilta, regards the verse Menaki v'tzadik al tarog, the guiltless and righteous you shall not kill, as an admonition addressed to the Beis Din, directing its members not to execute judgment when it is at all possible that the accused is innocent, i.e. when evidence is circumstantial in nature. Under Noahide code, as recorded by the Rambam, Malachim 9:14, the testimony of a single witness is sufficient for conviction and execution of the death penalty. This provision of the Noahide code is derived by the Gemara in Sanhedrin 57b from the phraseology employed in Bereshis 9:5, which establishes the culpability of Noahites for violations of the Sheva Mitzvahs. However, even before Noahide courts, just as in proceedings before Jewish courts, only uncontradicted testimony is acceptable as a basis for punishment, as is demonstrated by the Minchas Chinuch in Mitzvah Chof Vav. A confession of guilt is not admissible as evidence before a Jewish court. Whether or not a confession is admissible and constitutes sufficient grounds for conviction in Noahide courts is a matter of considerable dispute. Rabbi Aaron Alevi of Barcelona, who purportedly wrote the Sefer HaChinuch in Mitzvah Chof Vav, rules that a confession of guilt is sufficient for conviction under Noahide law. There is, however, no reference whatsoever to acceptance of a confession of guilt by a Noahide court, either in the Gemara or in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Rambam, in his commentary to Shmuel Beis 1:16, explains that the Amalekite lad who reported that he killed Melech Shaul was summarily executed because he stood convicted by his own mouth. Assuming that the term ger, used in describing the Amalekite lad, is in this instance to be translated as stranger rather than proselyte, in other words, not what we call a ger, but rather a stranger. See the Maaseis HaMelech of Rav Diskin al Rambam in Simen Reish Ayin Gimel, who suggests that ger is maybe a ger toshev. The Brisker Rav in his Chiddush HaRizal Rambam, on page 164, maintains that a Ger Toshav who subsequently renounces his acceptance of the seven commandments, of the Sheva Mitzvahs, reverts to his former status. So the Masis Melech with Diskin asserts that the Amalekite's declaration that he killed Shaul constituted such a renunciation, and hence he reverted to the status of an Amalekite and was put to death on that account. Rashi's comment is in agreement with the position of the Sefer HaChinuch. The Torah Tumima in Bereishis Tes Hei finds a source for this position in the Talmud Yerushalmi Kiddushin 1:1, but indicates that the meaning of the text is not entirely clear in his opinion. It is this textual ambiguity which accounts for the conflicting views with regard to the acceptance of a confession by Noahide courts. The very existence of a conflict with regard to acceptance of a confession serves to underscore the fact that other forms of evidence are not sufficient to establish guilt, even under the more relaxed laws of evidence which govern criminal proceedings in Noahide courts. Circumstantial evidence is clearly not of sufficient weight to compel Gentile courts to impose the death penalty by virtue of the Noahide obligation with regard to the fulfillment of the mitzvah of dinim. In fact, on the basis of the sources cited thus far, it would appear that Noahide courts have no right to impose the death penalty on the strength of circumstantial evidence. It should be noted that fingerprints, forensic evidence, and the like must be relegated to the category of circumstantial evidence. Shlomo Fisher talks about this in the Noam Journal in the second volume on pages 222 to 240. Also, the Mishmer Eschaim, he talks about it in Siman Lamed Zion. Blood tests are discussed by the Tvar Yehoshua, who's a Ganag Oinim, Yehoshua Ehrenberg, and the Tvar Yehoshua in Chilek Gimel, Ebenezer in Siman Hey. Polygraph evidence is discussed by Yehoshua Baum in the Emek Halacha, Volume 2, Siman Yedalad. There's a lot of other sources, these are just a few. Such evidence is inadmissible before Jewish courts, which require the testimony of two eyewitnesses, and would appear to be equally inadmissible before Noahide courts, where a single eyewitness is required for the imposition of the death penalty. In formulating a Jewish response to the debate concerning capital punishment, one highly significant point must be recognized. Even when state laws provide for the death penalty, e.g. in instances of first-degree homicide, this penalty is, in practice, seldom imposed on the basis of eyewitness testimony or even upon the defendant's entry of a guilty plea. It is indeed true that a guilty plea does not foreclose the possibility of a death sentence. There have been numerous instances in which courts have imposed the death penalty subsequent to a confession of guilt. However, such sentences, particularly in recent judicial practice, are relatively rare in instances in which a plea of guilt has been entered. Hence, a defendant who is mentally competent when he committed an act of homicide and is confronted with the unchallenged testimony of an unimpeachable eyewitness is likely to plead guilty. Of course, even when the act of homicide is not denied, the question of first-degree culpability may well become a trial issue. On balance, however, the death penalty is only infrequently imposed in situations in which, according to Rambam, capital punishment is required under the Noahide court. Code. The net effect of death penalty statutes is to establish a punitive system in which this penalty is more likely to be imposed upon defendants who deny guilt but nevertheless convicted despite contradictory testimony, or, as is more frequently the case, upon defendants who are convicted on the basis of evidence which halachic regards as circumstantial in nature. Noahides are clearly under no obligation to impose the death penalty under such circumstances. Whether or not Noahide courts enjoy discretionary authority to impose capital punishment in the absence of eyewitness testimony requires further clarification. It is indeed the case that, at least under certain circumstances, Jewish courts enjoy discretionary power to impose the death penalty even in the absence of the testimony of two eyewitnesses. Jewish law provides for what in effect constitutes two separate systems of justice and two parallel judiciaries. The Beis Din is obligated to enforce the law and to mete out punishment to transgressors as provided by the Torah. These responsibilities with regard to punishment of malefactors are mandatory and constitute a fulfillment of a mitzvah. Indeed, for Rambam, imposition of each of the four modes of execution is a separate and distinct mitzvah, and collectively imposition of the various death penalties constitutes four of the Taryag mitzvahs. Yet, as noted earlier, the stringent nature of the laws of evidence make it extremely difficult to obtain a conviction before a Beis Din. Such a situation would certainly tend to encourage criminal activity and might well result in a total breakdown of law and order. The prerogatives bestowed upon the king serve to rectify such a situation. The king is empowered to impose extrajudicial punishments as he sees fit in order to preserve the social order. The responsibilities of the monarch in the Jewish Commonwealth are twofold in nature. Number one, to lead the people in war. A vestige of this traditional function of the ruler remains even in contemporary non-monarchical societies such as the United States, in which the chief of state is titular commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And number two, to sit in judgment, i.e. to administer what may be termed the king's justice, the Mishpat HaMelech. The terms used by the Rambam in Roitzeach 2:4 and Sanhedrin 8:6 are Din HaMalchus, the law of the monarchy. These duties are elucidated in Shmuel Aleph in the 8th chapter and the 20th Pasuk. We also shall be like all the nations. Our king shall judge us and go out and before us and fight our wars. The Rambam Malachim 4:10 declares, a king is not appointed in the first instance other than for the purpose of executing judgment and waging wars. The monarch is empowered to punish malefactors in a manner more severe than is provided by biblical law. The Chasam Sofer in Aruch Chaim Resh Ches states that this authority is derived from Vayikra Chof Zayin Chof Tes. Ramban understands this pasuk is conferring upon the community the power of declaring a cherem and prescribes the death penalty for its violation. The Chasam Sofer suggests that the power is vested in the monarch by virtue of the acceptance of his authority and the concomitant duty of obedience owed him by the populace. Look also at what Rav Shaul Yisraeli writes in the HaTorah VaMedina, fascinating journal, which unfortunately no more appears, in ER, Tavshin Yud. Thus, he may, for example, decree the execution of an individual who has taken the life of another, even though the culprit's act does not, for various reasons, constitute capital homicide under biblical law. It should be noted that the Rambam, Malachim 3:8 and 3:10, in describing the royal prerogatives, speaks only of the crimes of lèse majesté and homicide. In Hilchos Rotzeach 2:4, the Rambam speaks of murderers and the like. Avnei Nezer and Yerideya, Chelik Beis, Simon, Shin Yud Beis, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli in the Torah VaMedina, in the second line, page 81, opine that the king's jurisdiction is limited to these crimes. Rav Ben Tzion, Ben Rav Binyamin Rabinowitz Tu'umim, in HaTorah VaMedina, in the fourth volume, which came out in Elul of 57:12, and page 74, understands the Rambam in this manner as well. See also the Arsamech, Malachim 3:10. This interpretation of the Rambam is difficult to sustain in light of the Rambam's own statement in Sanhedrin 18:6 to the effect that Achan, who was not guilty of homicide, was executed by virtue of application of the king's justice. However, the Ritva in the Shita Mekubetzes in Bav Metzedi 3b explains that Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon's actions in turning over thieves to government authorities, although sharply censured by Rabbi Yehoshua ben Karchel, was deemed appropriate in Rabbi Elazar's opinion because those individuals were lawfully liable to punishment by virtue of exercise of the royal prerogative. The Ritva apparently maintains that the king's authority extends to punishment of theft as well. The Rashba, in a tshuva published by Professor Kaufman in the Jewish Quarterly Review in the 8th volume, in 1896, going back a little bit, explains Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon's actions in the same action in the same manner, and further states that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha does not forbid such execution, but states only that as an act of piety, one should refrain from delivering the wrongdoers into the hands of government officials. The king, in administering justice, is not bound by strict laws of evidence as well. The Beis Din may also impose extraordinary punishment and ignore usual judicial procedure, but only as an emergency measure. Rambam, Sanhedrin 18.6, 24.4, Rotzeach 2.4, see also the Rambam in Mamrim 2.4, see also the Rambam in Melachim 3.10. One who murders without clear proof or without warning, even if in the presence of a single witness or an enemy who kills unintentionally, this is the Rambam speaking, the king has authority to execute him and to perfect the world in accordance with what this hour requires. Thus, the king is empowered to establish a system of justice not limited by the rigid rules of evidence, which severely circumscribe the power of the Beis Din to punish evildoers. The Rambam in Sanhedrin 18.6 states explicitly that the monarch is empowered to impose a death sentence upon the confession of the defendant. However, whether or not the king might act in a like manner upon circumstantial evidence is less clear. The rationale underlying the king's authority to suspend laws of evidence is not readily apparent. It is understandable that the king may be empowered to establish laws for the benefit of society and even to mete out punishment of greater severity than prescribed by biblical law. Those powers constitute the essence of the royal prerogative and are comparable to the obligation of Gentiles to provide for a just and well-ordered society, which constitutes the essence of the commandment of Dinim as enunciated by the Rambam. But relaxation of laws of evidence is another matter entirely. In requiring the testimony of two witnesses, the Torah in effect declares that a single witness is unreliable. His testimony does not establish judicial proof that an infraction of laws in fact occurred. The king may define additional crimes and establish more severe punishment. But by what power may he accept evidence that an infraction has occurred if the Torah explicitly declares such evidence to be inconclusive in establishing factual knowledge? So Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk in the Rosh Samech Melachim 3.10 resolves this difficulty by advancing the thesis that the royal prerogatives constitute simply the extension and applications of provisions of the Noahide Code to Jews. According to this view, the Noahide Code is superseded by the Sinaitic Code insofar as mandatory application is concerned, but nevertheless retains residual legitimacy, even with regard to Jews, to the extent that the king has discretionary authority to act on the rules of evidence by which Noahide courts are governed. According to this thesis, the Torah in acquiring two witnesses does not declare the testimony of a single witness to be untrustworthy, since it continues to admit such testimony under the Noahide Code, but simply provides that the Beis Din must be governed by more stringent rules of evidence. However, since a single witness is sufficient for conviction in a Noahide court, the king may accept such testimony as well. Acceptance of the Or Sameach's thesis should logically lead to the conclusion that a confession of guilt must be accepted and acted upon by Noahide courts. Since according to Or Sameach, only evidence admissible in Noahide courts may be acted upon by the king, the fact that the king may administer punishment on the basis of confession, as the Rambam says in Sanhedrin 18.6, must signify that such evidence is sufficient for conviction under Noahide law. However, acceptance of circumstantial evidence remains an open question. Accepting the thesis of the Or Sameach, it would follow that circumstantial evidence is either admissible by both the Noahide court and by the king's court, or by neither. The Or Sameach makes one further point, which has a direct bearing upon this question. The Rambam, Rotzeach 6.6, rules that a blood avenger may act upon the testimony of a single witness. This ruling is sharply contested by the Ravid, and indeed the Ravid's objection led the Kesef Mishnah to a reinterpretation of the Rambam's position. Or Sameach understands the Rambam in a literal way and justifies the Rambam's position in permitting a blood avenger to act on the testimony of a single witness. He explains that the blood avenger, the Goyal Hadam, like the king, is empowered to act in a summary manner because such action is necessary in order to preserve the social order. The function of the Goyal Hadam is similar to that of a king. In effect, declares the Or HaSameach, both are empowered to implement provisions of the Noahide Code. Insofar as the blood avenger is concerned, it would appear that both Rambam and Ravid agree that he may not act on the basis of circumstantial evidence. The Ravid rules that the Goyal Hadam may act only upon the testimony of two witnesses. The Rambam, in relaxing this requirement, speaks of the sufficiency of a single witness, but makes no mention of circumstantial evidence. Since the Goyal Hadam, the king, and Noahide courts must abide by the identical standard of evidence, would follow, according to the Or HaSameach, that circumstantial evidence may not be accepted either by the king's court or by a Noahide court. So this is just a part of what there is to say. And Amir Tzah Hashem, B'li Neder, we shall continue this fascinating discussion. Shalom, shalom, sweetest and most beloved friends.